Take your golf expertise to the next level with Links Premier, unlocking the most exciting and insightful coverage of the game's courses, travel, communities, architecture, and more. With Links Premier, our latest subscription tiers offer something for everyone. Whether you enjoy reading the print edition of Links, clicking through our digital magazine, scrolling around linksmagazine.com, or all of the above. Plus, subscribers receive priority notifications for exclusive Links events, a welcome discount code to the Links online shop, and much more. Get your all-access pass today by visiting linksmagazine.com and clicking the subscribe link. Welcome back to the Links Golf Podcast. I am digital editor for Links, Al Lunsford, joined by Joe Passoff. Joe, a new and highly anticipated golf book hit the shelves on March 26th. It's called Rainmaker, Super Agent Hughes Norton and the Money Grab Explosion of Golf, from Tiger Woods to Liv and Beyond. That covers a lot, Joe. It's published by Atria Books, a division of Simon & Schuster. And it was written by the two guests we have today on our podcast, our own Links editor, George Pepper, and the man himself, Hughes Norton, are here. Hughes, I think you're joining us from Cleveland, where you've lived for quite some time. Started there with your work with the International Management Group, also known as IMG, to a familiar name to many golf fans out there. How are you doing today, and what made you decide to write this book about your life and career?
Well, I really owe it to my collaborator, George, but I'll back up a step or two. I was fired by Mark McCormick, CEO of IMG, in the fall of 1998, December, actually. And along with that came a 10-year severance agreement, which was very attractive, but which also had a silencer on it in terms of not only preventing me from working in the sports management business for anybody else for 10 years, but also talking about or revealing anything about my career at IMG. So at that point, I had kind of had enough of running around the world chasing clients who often were unappreciative of our efforts, and was just ready to do something else and take it easy for a while. And then the 10 years ran out, and occasionally I would be with friends and golf stuff would come out and they'd say, "Hey, Hughes, tell us about this," or "What happened with Tiger?" or "The Greg Norman deal, what was..." And at the end of two or three beers, inevitably someone in the group would say, "You really ought to write a book." But I kind of just dismissed it, something that, yeah, sure, it'll never happen. And then 2 years ago, almost exactly, February 22, a young agent who was working at IMG said, "You know, there's this great podcast you really ought to go on. It's called No Laying Up. And the host, Chris Solomon's a friend of mine. How about if I set it up?" And I said, "Chris, honestly, I've never really talked about all those years. And so many writers and media people have come to me during that period saying, 'Hey, tell us about this,' or 'I'm writing a book about Tiger. We want your insights.' And I always refused. I just thought taking the high road was the way to go. And I was consistent with that. But I thought, what the heck? I'll try this podcast. It'll be fun." So the podcast came out. A couple of people on social media made remarks like, "God, that's one of the best things No Laying Up has ever done. I've never heard of Hughes Norton. That guy ought to write a book." I thought, And I dismissed that thought and opened the email one morning to find a missive from my longtime pal, George Pepper, saying, "Hey, heard your podcast, really enjoyed it. Is it finally time we wrote that book?" Quote unquote. And that triggered really a 20-month process, Al and Joe, into what ended up being a pretty cool story, I think, Rainmaker.
It just kept coming up. The idea wouldn't go away. So I'm very glad that George was the one that finally persuaded you to go down this path.
George, I hasten to add, I had always admired as a great writer, really in my estimation, the best golf writer of the generation I'd always enjoyed his stuff, had spent a lot of time with him, enjoyed him as a person. And I really felt that's a comfortable relationship to launch this book project with. And from the beginning, I knew, because he knew me so well, there was no one that could authenticate my voice in this first person narrative better than George.
So how did you two first meet then? I know you've been friends for quite a long time, and you've had some business relationships as well. George, can you tell us about when you first met Hughes or heard of him, and then how you guys connected?
Yeah, I can recall what I can. He and I both came into the golf business. We're about the same age. He's a couple years older, and we came into the golf business just about the same time. He again was a couple of years ahead of me. Kind of similar backgrounds. We each found ourselves with our dream jobs, I guess. And we were fairly young to have been able to kind of rise up fairly quickly. And I think we were both under the age of 30 when we found ourselves on the opposite side of a table negotiating a contract. I think the first one we did, Hughes, was Tom Watson. We were trying to get Tom Watson on Golf Magazine's masthead as a playing editor, which we succeeded in doing. And Hughes and I had to go toe-to-toe and negotiate that. And he was a hard son of a gun, I have to tell you that. Nobody wanted to be on the other side of the table from Hughes. And then we did, like, I remember we did a three-way deal with Peter Jacobson, Gary Hallberg, and Bobby Clampett, like three for the price of one, three young guns. And it went on from there, you know, Nancy Lopez, Greg Norman, I can't remember all of them, Curtis Strange. And so over the years, we had, I think it developed from a kind of a necessary business relationship to a very congenial, friendly relationship as well. We played some golf together, famously played that crazy 54 holes in one day at St. Andrews Pebble Beach and Wingfoot in Pebble Beach. And so yeah, we just had this, I think we've always been sort of kindred spirits in the golf world.
That's interesting. I know you told that story, George, about your 54 hole day. I didn't know that Hughes was with you for the ride.
Hughes was Bobby Clampett's agent at the time. So yeah, he was there on part of that one.
The best golfing invitation I've ever received in my career.
Damn right it was.
That would be a hard one to top for sure. Hughes and George, you both mentioned some of the names that Hughes worked with over the years as a sports agent. But Hughes, in the beginning, what led you down that path to becoming a sports agent and then qualifying with some of these names to earn the title of super agent that you have in your tie of your book?
Serendipitous, really. Al, I was a grad student at Harvard Business School. Well down the road to taking a job with a major broadcasting entity called Capital Cities Broadcasting, whose founder and number one guy were both graduates of HBS. And then second year of the program at Harvard, I took a course called Starting New Ventures about entrepreneurs who had started their own businesses. And lo and behold, a case popped up about IMG and some guy named Mark McCormick. We go into class the next day. Mark is actually there in the classroom, gets up and talks to us at the end of class a little bit about the company and how it started and where it was going. And I'm sitting there. This is 1972 now. It's hard to imagine in today's world where sports management has become so ubiquitous. I'm thinking, wait, this is a business? You can work in sports? How cool would that be? So I talked to him. He said, write me a letter. One thing led to another. And my famous job interview, I was meanwhile holding off Capital Cities, who had made me a very concrete offer to come work for them. But it was just too appealing, the thought of sports. And Mark came back to school a few months later for another presentation. My job interview, this classic McCormick, was driving him out to Logan Airport because he was in a hurry to go somewhere else, as he always was. And we're driving in the car and we get out to Logan Airport. He's asking me various questions. put this in context, we talk about it in the book. He asked me what the starting salary was in those days, early 1970s, for Harvard MBAs. Now, remember, today it's probably pushing 200,000. In 1972, it was $14,000 a year. We get to Logan Airport. I'm so enthralled with this conversation that I miss the ramp for American Airlines. And we have to circle all the way around Logan again. At this point, Mark's looking at his watch. I'm going to miss my flight. This kid's going to Harvard Business School and he can't find the ramp to American Airlines. That's what I'm thinking he's thinking. Anyway, long story short, he made his flight. I got a job offer. I waited against broadcasting. It was a tough decision. And I decided to go into sports management. And my first job was as Mark's administrative assistant, nothing to do with golf or any of our other sports, just doing projects for him across the whole, division, the whole company, all the divisions in the company. And a couple of months in, the guy who was our major client recruiter and client manager at the time left the company. And Mark said, "Hey, Hughes, you play golf. You love golf, right? How would you like to get into it and work with our clients and then end up recruiting some?" So that was my introduction. I was dispatched with really no preparation on my first trip out on tour in 1972, the fall, to a couple of tournaments on the West Coast. And I prepped by reading Mark's book, which is still a good read all these decades later. He wrote a book called Arnie, Evolution of a Legend, talking about how he got started with Arnold, all the stuff that happened. So armed with that and not much more, a 25-year-old Harvard Business School graduate who could barely read a contract at that point, walked onto the PGA Tour, and the rest kind of was history.
All right, Hughes, for those of us of a certain age who remember Mark McCormick's impact, his brilliance in building this empire, I get it. For younger folks who can't quite understand who Mark McCormick was, what led you to be so spellbound by this man and then the juggernaut that became IMG? Explain a little bit about Mark's magnetism, his business plan, and is it true he kind of kept track of every second of his time?
Well, he a lot of people have forgotten, Joe, that he started as a lawyer in Cleveland. In those days, as we talk about at length in the book, the professional golf tour was really a mom and pop operation. The purses were small. In the early days of the tour, most players were trying to play well enough to get offered an attractive club job. Like Claude Harmon won the Masters. His reward wasn't a whole bunch of prize money. It was the head pro job at Wingfoot. And so Mark and an associate of his in Cleveland started in the business of booking exhibitions around the country. What would happen is, for extra money, players would go frequently to towns that didn't have the PGA Tour, Portland, Maine, Omaha, Nebraska, and do a two-man or four-man exhibition at a club. And people who never got to see professional golf in those markets would come out and watch. It was quite a win-win thing for the players and for the fans in those regions. So Mark got into doing that. And in the process, had become friends with some of the tour players and gotten to know them. Famously, he went to William & Mary while Arnold Palmer was at Wake Forest, and those two golf teams played each other. Mark was on the William & Mary team. Arnold was number one man for Wake Forest. So they met. Mark got to know Arnold better through the exhibitions that he and his friend were doing kind of as a part-time business. And the more Mark was around players, the more it sort of dawned on him that none of these guys had any idea about contracts or business. Arnold famously gave Mark his Wilson Sporting Goods contract, which Mark was appalled to see, gave Wilson rights in perpetuity to Arnold's name, endorsement, etc., for golf bags, golf clubs, golf balls. Arnold was perfectly happy with that contract. He didn't know any better. And it dawned on Mark that, as in his words, he said something like, "I felt like Robin Hood because these guys were all getting ripped off so badly." And pretty soon, it became clear that a business opportunity was sitting there. And famously, Arnold, in the late 1950s, said, "Mark," and remember, Arnold had just won the Masters in 58. He won it again in 1960. He was taking the world by storm. Televised golf was starting to be a major factor. President Eisenhower was a keen golfer. All of this was kind of bubbling together. And Arnold said, I can't handle this, Mark. I need somebody full time. Are you interested?" Momentous decision for a young lawyer in Cleveland who had the security of working for a law firm. But he took the plunge. Shortly thereafter, a South African youngster named Gary Player came calling to ask Mark the same question. And Mark took him on. And then in 1961, Jack Nicklaus, just down the road in Columbus, turned pro and signed with Mark as well. So boom, out of nowhere, Mark is representing the three biggest names in golf. And from then on, the business just exploded. And eventually over the years, Mark decided to take what he'd learned representing and helping professional golfers to tennis players, to team sport athletes, to a whole wealth of other sports and pursuits where IMG really achieved phenomenal growth. And we go into that in great detail in the book. George researched a lot of that. I pitched in a few inside stories, and it's a fascinating account of not just my story as an agent. Yes, I had great success in the field and also some big failures, but it's a wonderful narrative of the growth of the pro tour from the early 70s to the juggernaut that it's become today. And also simultaneously, it's a wonderful account and history of the growth of IMG. The father of sports management was Mark, and we trace all that through too. So it's kind of a 3-for-1 story, which George blended together beautifully, and it's great fun to read.
I love some of the anecdotes with Mark in the book, and one of the ones that I remember is him negotiating the deal for the office of IMG and picking the 13th floor because he knew he could get a better price on it.
That was Mark.
The superstitious 13th floors of some places that people think about. But George, your impressions of this giant in the industry, Mark McCormick, as you were coming up and then even as you were researching and learning, diving deeper into his career, how did it work on your end and how you viewed him from your profession?
Yeah, I got to know him a little bit. I was always kind of, I think, as a lot of people were, a bit intimidated by Mark McCormick. He was about 6'5" and had a way about him. I wouldn't call it an arrogance. If he was arrogant, it was probably justified. He was one of these guys who was always two or three steps ahead of everybody else. And so he had that about him. But it's amazing what he accomplished, the breadth of the empire he built. I mean, if you think about his clients, he had Itzhak Perlman and he had Maggie Thatcher. I mean, he had Derek Jeter and he had the Pope. Can you imagine the Pope? He was a terrific salesman. You were right when you mentioned his time, every ounce of his time was taken up. He, as you can tell you better than I, he did everything on 3x5 cards and yellow line paper. I think he probably would have loved the computer if he got into it early enough. He probably resisted it in the end, but I think he probably would have made great use of that, and because it would have saved his time even more. But extremely organized. And he had the ability, one of his other lieutenants, Bob Kane, I think, said, to pay attention to the details while at the same time having a really clear view from 30,000 feet. And that's a rare talent. He was, I think Hughes will tell you, he's the most brilliant businessman he ever met.
No question. And he was always, George alluded to it, he was two or three steps ahead of all of us and the competition. And his biggest enemy was time. He just maximized every minute. Is a great thing in the book where someone was saying, Arnold was saying, you know, who nobody knew him better over the years. And Arnold said, you know, Mark would always cut conversation short, and he just had to jump onto the next thing. And it was disconcerting. And Dave Marr chipped in. Yeah, Mark definitely was hard of listening.
And he didn't he determine that his first marriage failed because by his calculation, he was only able to spend something like 32.7% of his time with the family.
Correct. 38%, he told me. And he kept track of everything. He kept track of the number of times his feet touched the ground. He kept track of how much time he spent with his family, how much time he spent on airplanes, which was probably in the course of his 72 years, several years worth. He would he was up at 4:30 in the morning calling overseas where it was the middle of the day, whether it, or the evening, whether it was Japan, whether it was Europe. He was a workaholic. Literally, his picture should be in the Webster's dictionary next to that word. Never stopped. And he was, it goes back to something I've always thought, guys, which is if you don't love what you do, and I think of George in this regard, because he loved writing and being the editor of Golf Magazine and all the stuff. If you don't, and I love my job, if you don't love what you do, I think it's very difficult to succeed, to really be at the top of whatever profession you're in. And Mark just loved it, loved it.
Hughes, did all of you get sucked into that particular vortex, meaning he demanded the same thing of his top people? And is that what your life was like and the other, you know, senior people you worked with?
Absolutely. In spades. And we talk about this in the book. You just get, you inevitably, I think, I can't speak for George, but you inevitably track a little bit toward the business style or the lifestyle of the person you report to or persons you report to in jobs. And in this case, Mark being so successful at what he did and me knowing nothing about sports management, I started to emulate him. I had the yellow pad. I worked the long hours. I just devoted all my energies into the job. So you kind of didn't get to be a top exec at IMG unless you were driven, unless you work really hard, unless you, you know, were willing to, no one was working as hard as Mark, but at least, you know, taking that approach to our jobs and be willing to fly anywhere at any time and be willing to make this the focus of your life. So yeah, guilty on that one.
Okay. I mean, it's, yes, that's true. It's also true of, you know, some of the gigantic law firms across the country and across the world, just kind of the way things go sometimes. But you did love what you were doing. So it was a little bit easier to go in neck deep and almost up to your eyeballs. So the 1970s morph into the 1980s, and IMG and golf are collecting one great client after another. What were some of the highlights of those years? And I know the book shares a low light or two about the golfers you had in the stable in the 1980s.
A low light or three, I think it's fair to say, George. it was, you know, the sequential nature was interesting. A couple of milestones, really landmarks along the way for me and the company. Mark had taken his eye off the ball. After Palmer, Player, and Nicklaus, he had a famous you know, moment of decision, as he described it. I could stay friends with these three, play a lot of golf, have fun, and make a whole lot of money just representing them. But I thought I could take what I'd learned and expand it into other areas, as we discussed. So we did that. In the meantime, some competitors showed up on the golf scene. When I first went out to the West Coast, to name two, Johnny Miller and Lee Trevino had just emerged on the scene, and they both had gone elsewhere. And so we needed to kind of put a stake in the ground again and say, hey, we might not have some of these young guys stars, but we are the company of Palmer, Player, and Nicklaus, and a lot more, and we got to get back on track. So sequentially, I was able to sign Tom Watson in 1975, who, interestingly enough, everyone thinks recruiting, well, you know, Watson was obviously going to be a superstar. He was a third-team All-American. There were 12 other young players that were judged better than he through his college years at Stanford. Just kind of illustrates how hard it is to pick the right people. You never know who's gonna be the next great star. But we signed Watson. He left after a year, but we had 1 year with him. That was an important milestone. The next year, 76, I signed both Curtis Strange and Nancy Lopez, and we talk about both of those wonderful people in the book and how it came about that I was able to recruit and sign them. That was major, because Lopez really became the star of the LPGA Tour for the next decade at least. And Curtis made the statement, hey, we are back. We signed the number one college prospect in the nation. You know, IMG is here again. And that morphed over the years. Greg Norman was next, represented Greg for 11 years. David Duval was then. These are all number one players, by the way. So I guess I'm on the fifth number one player that I recruited and signed over my career, which was David Duval. And then finally, a guy named Tiger Woods. So we trace all that in the book. We track it. Lots of successes, lots of failures. Tried to be authentic about this, guys. George and I made that commitment to each other at the beginning, and I said, George, I'm going to tell you the bad as well as the good. Otherwise, it's not real. And I think we pulled that off pretty well.
Yeah, George, just before we go into the Tiger stuff, because we included an excerpt from the book in our summer issue, our spring issue of Lynx. But just what is it like writing a book, you know, in someone else's voice? I know you've said many times the words are yours, the story is his. But what is that process like for you?
You know, in this case, it was incredibly easy because I think you can almost see Hughes and I, as I say, are kind of kindred spirits. We're both kind of type A personalities. We talk relatively quickly, same age. The only other time I tried it was when I co-wrote Cinderella Story with Bill Murray. And I remember giving him the first chapter, and he looked at it, he said, how long did it take you to write this? I said, well, I don't know, a couple of weeks. And he hesitated for me. Well, it's good, but it's not me. And he was right. He ended up writing 90% of that book, and it was a totally different voice that I could never have mimicked. So I think we started out kind of serendipitously in that we're similar folks, Hughes and I. And as you can hear, despite Hughes' advanced age, his mind is still pretty good, and he can put words together fairly quickly and glibly. He came down to Charleston. We sat for a couple of days and a couple of pretty intensive days and just talked and talked and talked. To Hughes' credit and to my great relief, he is also sort of a pack rat. He's clipped everything for years, and he brought down literally a suitcase full of archival material that, as we sat there, he would grab into his folder and pull out some little letter to some player, and that just enhanced the narrative, made it so much easier for me. So I was basically the caddy on this one.
Hughes, did he nail it?
He more than nailed it. It flows so beautifully, and it isn't just me. I'm too close to it to tell. You know, when you edit something over and over, as we did together, draft after draft, so many people that have read it thinks that it's an easy read. It's a book that you just don't put down. It flows beautifully. One of the greatest comments we got, and he wrote a blurb for us on the back of the book, as did Jim Nance, and as did Rick Riley and some really cool people, Wally Uhlein, Chris Solomon of No Laying Up. Curtis read it and said to George, "You know what I like best about this? It's the authenticity of Hughes taking the blame as well as sharing the success. He's real about stuff that happened." And that meant a lot. That was really what we set out to do. And Curtis, unbeknownst to our commitment to each other, affirmed that. And it certainly made me feel good, and I'm sure George.
Yeah, I think we did a pretty good job of that. I always felt to make the Hughes, the protagonist, likable, he has to be as humble as possible. And that came easily to him. As he said, that was always his intent, to tell the story warts and all. And I think probably Hughes's reputation when he left the business was among some people as being arrogant and, you know, satisfied with his success. And I think this look back from the perspective of 25 years makes him a real, not just a super successful guy, but a mensch.
Yeah, the end of that Curtis Strange quote, he says, "He spares no one in telling his story, including himself. This book may rankle a few people, but it's all the truth." I really enjoyed hearing that from Curtis. Take your golf expertise to the next level with Lynx Premier, unlocking the most exciting and insightful coverage of the game's courses, travel, communities, architecture, and more. With Lynx Premier, our latest subscription tiers offer something for everyone. Whether you enjoy reading the print edition of Lynx, clicking through our digital magazine, scrolling around lynxmagazine.com, or all of the above. Plus, subscribers receive priority notifications for exclusive Lynx events, a welcome discount code to the Lynx online shop, and much more. Get your all-access pass today by visiting lynxmagazine.com and clicking the subscribe link. So in 1989, you find yourself in Cypress, California, and look up in the phone book, the home of Earl and Tita Woods. Can you tell us about the first time you met with the Woods family, and what were the biggest impressions you left at initial meeting?
I felt a bit like an idiot, to be honest. I was calling on a soon-to-be 13-year-old in a world of golf, at least, where nobody turned pro, with a couple of exceptions, Seve Ballesteros being one of them. Nobody turned pro until they'd gotten a couple of years or further in college. You know, Curtis Strange, 3 years in college, turned pro. David Duval, 3 years in college, turned pro. And here I am, actually being mocked by my IMG colleagues who dropped me off at the Woods home that day, saying, "Okay, Hughes, I guess we're going into tennis now. We're chasing the 12 and 13-year-olds," which, by the way, those kids in tennis do turn pro at a very young age. So anyway, I had just I had talked to Earl previously. I was a clip and save guy, as George just referenced. We had no internet, no computer to speak of in those days. So I would just keep track of a whole bunch of young prospects. And I listed the six number one guys that we signed. And it sounds as if I did a pretty good job in that. But I also missed a lot of people. You inevitably do, whether you're a talent scout in the entertainment field or music or sports. It's just the nature of the business. You're not gonna find them all. But in this case, this kid had been tearing the world apart in junior golf. And so I wanted to make sure I got there, if not first, early, and explained to the parents, Earl and Tita in this case, what IMG was, what our history was, what our capabilities were, what our resources were. Hey, and in 6 or 8 years down the road, we hope you'll talk to us. That was essentially the conversation. And as we recount in the book, toward the end of the visit, Tiger showed up, 5'5" and about 120 pounds, if that, at the time. Nice kid, took me back to his room, showed me all the posters on the walls, which weren't hot chicks from the entertainment business or music stars, but they were posters of Nicklaus and Norman and all the greats in golf, Palmer. And with that, as I sat back down in the living room, Tiger said, "Got to go, Mom and Dad." And I looked out the window, and here's my future superstar client riding away on his bike.
One of my favorite moments from that visit you had was when he showed you his room, and there was a notable absence of trophies. And he said, "Yeah, by the time I turned 11, there were 113 of them, and Mom made me get rid of them." And he said, "I don't care."
A real insight into his character at the time, and I came to appreciate it later, guys, which is it was the next event, the next competition, the next tournament. That's all that mattered to him. He did not look backwards. He could tell what 13-year-old lets his mom throw his trophies into the garbage.
I think I still have a few of the trophies in my childhood bedroom at home. My mom will not get rid of. So, yeah, a little different perspective there.
Hugh, so at that time, you now without your colleagues, and you left to go home. What were your dealings subsequent with Tiger and Earl and Tita up until the time you guys actually signed him?
Very casual, Joe, to be honest. You know, as I referenced, he was years away in my head, and we just, you know, drop him a line from time to time, pick up the phone and call. Didn't want to overdo it. Did not make a recruiting pitch in the living room that day very carefully. It's premature. And just kind of stayed in touch then. And, you know, a couple of years later, 91 to be exact, he won his first junior amateur. I went to that event because we didn't do much junior scouting in those days, if at all. But I thought, you know, here's a chance to reconnect with Earl and Tiger, say hi to him. And then he won the next year, two juniors in a row, which is an incredible feat, by the way. George and I kind of reference this in the book. Tiger's career has been full of so many just mind-blowing achievements and accomplishments. But I honestly believe winning three consecutive U.S. junior amateurs, when, remember, the first one, he's 14 years old and he's playing some 17-year-old kid, 6 inches taller and 50 pounds heavier, who hits it 40 yards by him. But to do that in consecutive years and win three junior AMs in a row, nobody's ever done it. Yes, the three consecutive U.S. amateurs which followed are impressive, but that was pretty amazing. So about the second junior AM, I'm thinking, you know, this is really something special here. And then about that time, I had a brainstorm driving home from work one day, which was this. Hey, we're not scouting junior golfers. And maybe it is premature because of so many years between that time in their lives and when they eventually turn pro. But who could better give us a reading on the junior golf scene than Earl Woods? He's flying around the country to 15, 20 events a year with his son. And I'm thinking, if we paid Earl Woods to be our talent scout, it would be a win-win-win. How so? Earl was on a pension from the military. It's expensive, two airfares, hotel room, ground transportation, doing a 20-event circuit. And he was a little stretched. He had made that clear to me. Two, we had nobody out there checking out the possible future stars. And three, what a way to build a better bond between IMG and Tiger and his dad, Earl. I didn't think it could possibly work because of USGA amateur rules. But Mark, at that time, had become friendly with Sandy Tatum, who was head of the United States Golf Association. I told my brainstorm to Mark. He said, "I like it. Let me talk to Sandy." I thought that would be the end of it. Lo and behold, a week or so later, Mark came back and said, "It's a go, provided and only provided that there is no quid pro quo," meaning Earl coming to work for IMG in this regard could in no way have a condition or clause or even a verbal understanding that as a result, he would agree to his son signing with IMG. And although I was accused of that actually happening behind the scenes, it never did. It was totally an understanding, a handshake. It was never anything but something that was greatly appreciated by Earl and Tiger. And as I say, I had been the first one there. I had stayed in touch over the years. We built this relationship where it really helped the Woods family financially. And, you know, probably one of the smarter things I ever did. Did a lot of dumb things, too.
Well, Al, we've heard about the recruitment, so to speak, and the process. And then 1996 comes. Tiger has now won his third straight amateur. Phil Knight is on the scene in Portland when Tiger makes a phenomenal comeback to win that third straight amateur. What's going on with Hughes Norton and IMG as September of 1996 or end of August is coming our way?
Well, behind the scenes, a year or so prior, you know, nothing happens all that quickly, especially the kind of things that I was able to do for Tiger right before he turned pro. So a year or so previously, it had become clear Tiger had accomplished everything in college and amateur golf he could do. He'd won six straight USGA match play championships. He'd won 10 tournaments in his first 2 years at Stanford, 10 college tournaments, including the NCAA championship. And his game wasn't going to get any better staying in college, and it was time. So armed with that sort of feeling in the Woods camp, which they conveyed to me, I set out a basic strategy of trying to get him as heralded a prospect as he was, maybe the greatest to come along ever, certainly as promising at that stage as Jack Nicklaus was right before he turned pro. How do we maximize his financial situation when he turns pro so that he never, ever again has to worry about money and he can do what he's seemed to be born to do, which is go win championships and become the greatest golfer ever. So how do you go about that? You could try to do 10 endorsements. You could try to do none and just see what happened. But as Mark taught us, there are two times to really capitalize on a client's achievements, you know, his in whatever sport he's in. There's two times to financially capitalize. The first is when he turns pro and based on what he's accomplished to that point, when he comes out. The second one is after he makes it. And we talk in the book about Ben Crenshaw being a classic example of Ben did not sign with us when he turned pro. He did years later. I worked with him. But Ben missed the first opportunity. He had friends in Austin, Texas, advising him. Ben chose to do nothing. And then he kind of had a slump for a few years. And so he's missed the first opportunity. So I was determined we weren't going to do that. I had learned that from Mark. And it's, we talk about it in the book. It's great stuff. I basically took a gamble and decided that we do a couple of deals. First, the obvious one, the golf equipment that Tiger was playing with or would play with was a natural. The second was what clothes and shoes would he wear? And without belaboring it, I took a calculated risk and went to one company, Nike, and I started quite a ways before he turned pro, just quietly approaching them and saying, look, I'm not his agent. Just to be clear, I'm not breaking any NCAA rules. I'm not breaking any. He's not jeopardizing his USGA status. The family's just asked me to inquire what might be possible. And out of that, long story short, Joe, Tiger turned pro with $60 million in the bank. And we take great pains to talk about this because I think it's really significant. The $60 million over 5 years, 40 from Nike, 20 from Titleist, was fully guaranteed. And what does that mean? Tiger could have slumped terribly and never panned out. And there are lots of young kids that don't, despite incredible amateur achievements. The $60 million was his. There was no way that the two companies could get out of paying the contractual amounts of money. And in addition, there were very, very attractive bonuses for if he did become a great player, win major championships, etc. And that really, I felt, would give Tiger the peace of mind to know that he never had to worry about stuff again. And it, I contend to this day, it's a huge factor in why he played so well so quickly. It just matters. You can't have any uncertainty in your mind. It's hard enough being a tour pro and succeeding without worrying about, am I making enough money on this contract, or what's going to happen if I don't play well, et cetera. And just as a last backdrop, not to belabor this, remember Tiger, despite the phenomenal amateur match play success, had fizzled terribly in the PGA Tour events where he got sponsors exemptions to play. He played in 8 PGA Tour events from age 16. His first one was at the LA Open, close to home, until he turned pro. 8. Guess how many times he missed the cut? 7. And this was the backdrop of, now wait a second, Hughes, says Nike. I know this kid played great amateur golf, but he can't make a cut in PGA Tour events. How do we know he's going to be any good?
Yeah, I mean, we had just seen Scott Verplank and Phil Mickelson win big PGA Tour events as amateurs, and here Tiger hadn't really made a dent in that. George, from your perspective, the game by that point was mostly focused on the professional tours, especially the men's PGA Tour. And here's Tiger wins his first amateur, I think at Sawgrass at the TPC, and then Newport Country Club comes back and beats Buddy Marucci in 95. And then 96 happens and so forth. You know, in your perspective from the media, what was the Tiger phenomenon that was building, or was it a little overblown as we look at it all these years later?
Yeah, I think it probably wasn't until that last amateur at Pumpkin Ridge that people really started to take notice of. He had played in the Masters that year as well. So, and probably a couple, maybe, I don't know whether he got it. Yeah, surely played in a couple of US Open. So the Tiger mania was beginning to build. But when he made that 6th in a row national championship, I mean, it was just crazy. He came on to the tour with bigger buildup by far, more anticipation than anyone. You know, if Bobby Jones had turned pro, I suppose it would have been the same. I really think he was the biggest phenom since Bobby Jones. Nicklaus was big, but not like Tiger Woods. It was just an incredible. I can remember we had a cover of Golf Magazine back at the time, and it was one word headline, Tiger Mania. And that's what it was, and Hughes was in the middle of it.
Hughes, I seem to remember a time late in 1996 that the President's Cup was going on, but Tiger was in contention at the Quad Cities Classic, and like a third of the major media left the President's Cup to go cover the Quad Cities or Hardee's or something like that. Do you remember all that was swirling that autumn?
It was insane. I mean, I talk in the book about I was old enough barely to remember the powerful celebrity gale force of Elvis Presley when he hit the scene in the mid to late 1950s. And the Tiger Mania thing was a tsunami. I mean, it was just nuts. He would get up early in the morning to go play a practice round to beat the crowd, 6 a.m. You'd get there. The parking lot was full. Fans were lined up 3 and 4 deep to watch Tiger Woods play a practice round. It was crazy. It was every newspaper, every sports broadcast. He was front and center. What's he doing today? What did he shoot now? Has he got a chance? It was a maelstrom of activity, fun, but very demanding, both on Tiger, who bore the brunt of it, and me trying to shield him from it as best I could.
And so in that maelstrom, understandably, people who wanted to be connected to Tiger, specifically advertisers, but anybody in the television entertainment sphere, everything, all of this had to be filtered through you. How did you deal with that professionally, and how was it affecting you personally?
In the first 6 to 9 months, we calculated that IMG, me, and the team that I had assembled there to work with Tiger, received over 1,500 requests, 1,500 requests for interviews, for sit-downs, for anything. Please let us have a piece of Tiger's time. And very quickly, I was able to piss off the entire print and broadcast media, because we just simply said no to 99% of it. It's the only way to keep sanity. And remember, Tiger was supposed to be out there playing golf, not doing promotional interviews. So it was crazy. And we talk in the book about the autograph requests. I mean, thousands of pieces of mail would come to Tiger's home in California. People found that out. They'd come to IMG. They would come to tour spots. I'd go to a tour event and be in the locker room next to him. He'd go out to play, and sitting there was all, you know, a bag of stuff that had come to address to the tournament. And 20 minutes later, another tournament volunteer came in and dumped another bag in his locker. I mean, it was crazy, crazy stuff.
Well, it didn't slow down. I mean, I know that you said less than 2 years later, Tiger let you go, but he would go off, and the type of popularity you're talking about and people waiting to see him in early hours, none of that slowed down. And if anything, it got greater over the years. We want to leave a lot of the stuff, though. We don't want to read the listeners the entire book here on the podcast. Let them read it for themselves. But I do want to know, with your experience working with Greg Norman and now to where the game is, was the writing on the wall for what's happened in the professional game today? And where do you see it going from here? I mean, could you tell that something like this, just from your inner workings, was going to happen, inevitable? I know there were ideas a long way back about something similar, but could you forecast what golf is today?
It's interesting. Mark, we talk about this in the book at length. Mark, as usual, three steps ahead of everyone, in this case, five decades ahead of everyone, thought up the idea of a separate, smaller tour with just the top players back in the mid-1960s. And he wrote about it at length in his book, Arnie. And he laid it all out. He had all the bases covered. He had sponsors. He had more prize money. He had benefits like health and insurance for players that were unheard of in those days. And he approached Arnold about it, and Arnold shot it down. Never went anywhere. It came up again in the early years that I spent at IMG. We talked about it. Arnold shot it down again. And then in 1994, when Greg Norman, who essentially heard about this second pro tour idea from me in our 11 years together, Greg tried to put it together and failed, because once again, Arnold Palmer said, we can't do this, guys, to the rest of the tour players. They'll be left with nothing. So in the current environment, my prediction forecast, there has to be settlement. Right now, you have a PGA Tour diluted by the absence of DeChambeau and Koepka and Johnson and Cam Smith and Phil Mickelson and now John Rahm. I'm on a text chain with some friends that used to work in the business. And for the last 4 or 5 weeks, we've been hitting each other up Saturday morning saying, can you believe this leaderboard in LA? Who are these people? We don't recognize any of these names. Meanwhile, sponsors on the tour are being asked to pay more and more money, and they're getting less and less stars. So it can't go on, guys. It can't. LIV is struggling in its own right. Forget the financial side of it. They can't get a TV deal. They don't get much media coverage, except for those six stars who defected. They don't have much that attracts golf fans to watch out there. A lot of sort of has-been players. We saw this in tennis 20, 30 years ago when there was war between the governing bodies and the players. And guess what happened? The majors in tennis, Wimbledon, U.S. Open, Australian Open, French Open, became all that anybody cared about. Why? Because that was the only time that all the stars came together to play. I fear we're on that same track now. Tennis got all of its other events on tour were so unappealing, they ended up on ESPN2, and nobody ever paid attention to them. I think there has to be settlement. It's inevitable. They're still sniping at each other. They haven't settled. They've gone to other alternatives with these corporate American corporations and sports owners coming in to help the PGA Tour. I'd be interested in George's prediction as well. But for my money, this can't continue or golf is going to suffer.
Yeah, I mean, the ratings are flat at best, and that is worrisome, it would seem to me, if you're running a golf tour. And, you know, when you don't get the eyeballs, when people aren't interested, you're not going to be able to sustain this kind of money. I don't care who the investor is, whether it's the Saudis or the private equity guys from the U.S. They're going to want some sort of a return. And if the tour appeal is not there, and interestingly, as we all know, at least us four, you know, amateur golf numbers are going great. Well, everything is up. Participation, rounds played. So the amateur game is just fine as the professional game struggles to not kill itself. So that can't go on forever, it seems to me.
Well, Joe, unless you have anything else, I'm comfortable wrapping up here. Any other questions from you?
No, I mean, it's clear from what we talked about today and what we didn't talk about but hinted at, there is so much fun reading to be had when you actually grab the book and sit down. You know, we talk about catnip for professional golf fans. I mean, this is it. This is the most insidery stuff that you will ever read. And so it's just going to be an irresistible book. It was really fun to talk about some of it on today's podcast.
Yeah, and again, as of this podcast being released, the book will have been out on March 26th. Again, it's called Rainmaker, Super Agent Hughes Norton and the Money Grab Explosion of Golf from Tiger Woods to Live and Beyond. And you just heard from the book's two authors. We appreciate their time, Hughes and George. Thanks again. I hope we find an excuse to have a conversation again in the future. If you have enough material to write another book, maybe there's a sequel in your future, but we'll see what happens there.
There's an audio version, which I spent 18 hours in the studio doing, and that was a blast, and I'll be really interested to see how that does. But it was a new experience for sure.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate the plug.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Joe and Al. Appreciate it.
Thank you both for your time.